I tell you what, our weekends come around very quickly, and we always look forward to talking to this man. Dr. Ross Walker is on the phone. Hello, Ross.
Good morning, Brent. Lovely to talk to you, mate.
Mate, I trust you are well this week.
Very well indeed. Very well. I've just enjoyed a week in Victoria, lecturing down in Warrnambool and driving along the Great Ocean Road. It's just been magnificent.
That is a drive one of these days I hope my wife and I get to take, Ross. So I envy you, mate.
I would recommend it to all of the listeners. It's a fantastic thing to do.
Listener questions, as always, start us off each and every Saturday morning. Alice says, my grandfather has dementia. Does it run in families? In other words, do I have a higher chance of getting it later in life than a family that has no recent history of dementia?
Look, I say all the time that all disease is genetic, whether we're talking about heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's disease, dementia. And let me also say about dementia. Dementia is the blanket term for any condition that causes a chronic loss of memory and loss of cognitive function. So, for example, there's some nonsense out there that statin drugs can induce dementia. No, they don't. In about 20% of cases, they might induce a reversible memory loss that when you stop the drug, the memory comes back. That's not dementia. So, yes, there is a strong genetic component to all aspects of dementia, and there is a weak chance that Alice may develop dementia as she gets older. But there's another issue here. We're talking about what's happening now and what might happen in 30, 40, 50, 60 years' time. And the treatments that are coming through for dementia are very, very promising. Not the ones we have right at the moment, but the ones that are in the pipeline. They're even talking about a vaccination for dementia. And so the potential of Alice experiencing the same things that her grandfather's experiencing at the moment are close to zero. But let me also make the point, there is a particular blood test that you can have right now called ApoE. And the ApoE, or apolipoprotein E, is a cholesterol-carrying protein that a lot of people haven't heard of before. And we're born with three types, either ApoE 2, 3, or 4. Now, as most people realize, as far as genes go, all genes are paired. You get one gene from mum, one gene from dad. So most people are what we call ApoE 3-3. So they get a 3 ApoE gene from mum and a 3 ApoE gene from dad. But if you've got, say, 3-4, that increases your risk for dementia in your 70s and 80s. If you've got 4-4, and I've got to say that Chris Hemsworth, the actor, recently came out and found that he's had some blood tests and he is ApoE 4-4, that increases your risk for dementia in your 40s, 50s and 60s. But as I keep saying, we are getting newer treatments for this and newer ways to overcome it. So, for example, I'll be talking next week on the show about some studies that are showing the combination of brain training and a thing called direct cranial stimulation can significantly reduce the progression from mild cognitive impairment, which is where you start to experience symptoms that may indicate dementia, to full-blown dementia. So these two techniques that don't involve drugs can actually significantly reduce your risk for progressing. So just to reassure Alice, yes, her risk for dementia is slightly higher if her grandfather has it, but by the time she gets to her grandfather's age, we should have had dementia completely treated with things like vaccinations or much more sophisticated targeted therapies.
Dean has written in. He wants to know, he said, a couple of weeks ago, you talked about ashwagandha. He said, I think you said you actually take it, Dr. Ross. Could you tell me more about it, please? What is it used for?
Ashwagandha is a commonly used herb. That is, some people use it for or think it may have some effect on longevity. It's certainly there for stress relief, so people experiencing anxiety can take ashwagandha. It's very safe, and it is modestly effective.
Is it good for sleep?
Not that I'm aware of. I think it's ever been touted as something for sleep, but it certainly is given to people who are suffering anxiety.
So if Dean was to take ashwagandha, it would do him more good than harm?
Oh, sure. No doubt at all.
Arthur says, what are the common symptoms of vitamin D deficiency and how can it be treated, Ross?
There are absolutely no symptoms of vitamin D deficiency, but you see, it's a difference between what are the symptoms and what are the manifestations. Because a symptom is something that you experience, but a manifestation that is something that a doctor may pick up. So, for example, people who are vitamin D deficient There's a link between low vitamin D, which tragically a third of the Australian population, despite the fact that we live in the skin cancer capital of the world and you get vitamin D from the sun, but a third of people are vitamin D deficient, and there is a link between low vitamin D and risk for osteoporosis, heart disease, cancer, type 2 diabetes, multiple sclerosis, dementia, asthma. And even during the COVID pandemic, they found that people who had vitamin D levels around 100, which is the targeted level that I like to get to, you don't want it too high, but you certainly don't want it low. People who had it around 100 had lower rates of COVID, COVID complications and COVID death, because there's a lot of evidence now to show that vitamin D is also linked to a very healthy immune system. So there are no specific symptoms of vitamin D deficiency, but there are certainly many manifestations of it.
June has emailed in. She would like to know, Ross, how does stress affect blood pressure? And what are the best ways to manage stress-related blood pressure?
Now, how does stress drive up your blood pressure? Well, there's a hormonal basis and also a lifestyle factor. The way it drives up your blood pressure by hormones is that there are two glands that sit above the kidneys called the adrenal glands. And the adrenal glands are basically our stress glands. So the adrenal glands, the outer bits, make a thing called cortisone, and cortisone-related products we call mineralocorticoids, and the inner bits make adrenaline. So if you're chronically stressed, you're overstimulating your body with cortisone and with adrenaline. Both things raise your blood pressure. The cortisone draws fluid into the body and the adrenaline constricts arteries. So that's the pathophysiologic way of how stress can push up your blood pressure. But the lifestyle factor way is that when you're under stress, you don't have the same impulse or the same drive to exercise regularly, to eat properly, to maybe avoid substances you shouldn't be avoiding. So, for example, people who have far too much alcohol drives up their blood pressure. People who use illegal drugs drives up their blood pressure. People who eat bad food, which is full of a lot of salt, that drives up your blood pressure. And I think you get the gist of what I'm saying. So the way to reduce the stress effects on the blood pressure is to try and reduce the way you respond to the stress and to reduce the stresses in your life. And unfortunately, things happen to all of us, and when they do, they make you stressed and they can drive up your blood pressure. So the more you can get the stresses out of your life, but also learn to deal with those stresses, the lower your blood pressure is going to be.
Ross Candace wants to know, what's the difference between a viral and a bacterial infection, and how can each be treated?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the thing that might shock a lot of people, all of these things are microbes, but in fact, the virus is not living. So the virus is really a piece of junk DNA or RNA and some proteins all mixed in together that gets into your cells and screws around your cellular mechanisms, whereas a bacteria is a living organism that has its own cell wall and basically it gets into the body and can set up infections via a different mechanism. Both mechanisms then induce an immune response. So when you have, for example, a viral sore throat and your throat is incredibly uncomfortable, it's not from the virus per se, but it's from the immune response setting up incredible acute inflammation in your throat doing it. And the same thing can happen if a bacteria gets into your throat or anywhere in the body. So, for example, 90% of chest infections are related to viruses, and even then doctors give out antibiotics when they don't do a damn thing, whereas almost all urinary tract infections are bacterial in nature. So if you have a bacterial pneumonia, that's different to a viral pneumonia, and the treatment is different because antibiotics only work against bacteria. And in fact, if you take antibiotics when you have a virus, it destroys all your gut bacteria, and so therefore you lose that extra layer of immune protection. So it's best to avoid antibiotics when you're sick. But this has been the problem, and I remember when I was a kid, I'd get a runny nose and my mother would have me up to the doctor. I've had so many courses of antibiotics through my life, that it really has a bad effect on your gut microbiome, and it actually takes longer to get over a viral infection if you're taking antibiotics. The question is knowing when it is a bacteria as opposed to when it is a virus. And so for example, with a chest infection, you might be coughing and coughing and coughing, but then if you start coughing up very green, very thick sputum, it may have turned bacterial, but I still say it's good to have your sputum cultured to be sure if you really need to have the antibiotics for all the reasons I said. Now, up until the last decade or so, apart from some very, very specific viruses, we've really had no antiviral mechanism, antiviral treatments. And during COVID, they then developed these very specific antivirals that do work against the COVID virus but don't work against other viruses. For example, if you have herpes simplex on your lip or herpes general herpes simplex, there are specific antivirals that can get rid of that very quickly, and also specific antivirals for herpes zoster, the shingles infection that you get. But if, just for example, if you get shingles, which is a viral infection from the herpes zoster virus, and it's the same virus as the chickenpox virus, if you don't get onto treatment within about 72 hours, then the antivirals don't work. So hopefully that's a bit of an overview for Candice and explains to her exactly what she's asked.
How do viruses get into your system in the first place? Do you just breathe them in, walking around?
Typically, it is from respiratory droplets. So they're living in the cells of other people's respiratory mucosa. They cough those cells out, and then they land into our body, and the viruses then cross over into our cells. But you can also get it just from surfaces as well, which is why that we always say wash your hands for 20 seconds when you go to the bathroom with soap, because, again, hopefully that'll shed most of the viruses from any surfaces. But and also you can get it from food, sometimes from food, but certainly from person-to-person contact. There's a lot of viruses you can get in that way as well.
Thank you, Ross. That's our listener questions for this week. Let's do some topics. Polypharmacy. I've never heard of that until you sent through your notes. Polypharmacy defined?
Polypharmacy is when people are on five or more drugs. And tragically, that is the case for many people, especially over the age of 65. It's suggested that 30% of older adults are on some form of polypharmacy. So they did a study where they looked at people over the age of 65 and looked at those who had signs of dementia in varying degrees, dementia with polypharmacy, dementia by itself, polypharmacy by itself without dementia, or neither. And they found that especially in people that had features of dementia, the polypharmacy markedly increased their risk for poor health outcomes. Things like falls, medication interactions, hospitalisation, and even increased risk for death. So the bottom line from this discussion is that if anyone is on multiple medications, they should be constantly having those reviewed with their pharmacist and their doctor to see whether some of them can be dropped. Because I'll give you an example in my specialty with treating blood pressure. Often, especially as somebody gets into their 70s and 80s, their blood vessels are getting very stiff. And you give them a blood pressure pill because they've come into your office and their blood pressure is quite high, but they go home and their blood pressure drops back down to a normal level. You put them onto two or three medications for their blood pressure, and their blood pressure drops precipitously at home, and they can get very dizzy, fall over, and crack their skull. That's just one example of how you've got to be very, very careful with the medications you use in people.
Though standing is often promoted as a remedy for the harms of sitting, studies are now showing it can increase the risk of circulatory issues, making it no more beneficial for heart health than sitting for long periods, Ross.
Yeah, and see, a lot of people now have moved to these standing desks. So University of Sydney did a study where they looked to see whether the standing desks were actually beneficial. So they put these trackers on people to track the amount of time they sat, the amount of time they stood, and the amount of time they moved. And they found that of course, movement is good for you. There is absolutely no dispute about that whatsoever. But people who just stand in the one spot for too long, so just say you're at work and you've got a standing desk, as soon as you go beyond about 2 hours of standing in the one spot, you markedly increase your risk, not just for standard heart disease like congestive heart failure, coronary heart disease, stroke, but also a thing that's called orthostatic cardiovascular disease, which is basically disease you get from standing in the one spot too much. Things like orthostatic hypotension, what I was just talking about with the drop in your blood pressure. varicose veins, chronic venous insufficiency, and venous ulcers. And they found that for every 2 hours standing, every 30 minutes beyond that, 11% increased risk for the standard cardiovascular disease, but a 26% increased risk for every half an hour you stand beyond 2 hours.
Does alternating between sitting and standing improve heart health?
Oh yeah, of course it does. But what I'm saying is, when you get up, just say you're sitting down for about 20 minutes, half an hour, you should get up and move around, not just get up and stand in the one spot. So see, there is no doubt that people who move, who do a lot of steps every day, especially people who have a dedicated exercise program, are the healthiest people on the planet. I heard a lovely thing that I think I might have said last week on the show, but there is no such thing as healthy aging without exercise.
Low-level lead poisoning, even low-level lead exposure, poses serious health risks, causing cognitive defects in children and contributing to cardiovascular disease in adults. It remains a major global public health concern.
Yeah, and a lot of people wouldn't even think about this, especially living in our society. Now, with the increasing wokeness that's crept into society, you're no longer allowed to say developed countries and developing countries. You've now got to call people living in developed countries, they're now industrialized countries. And people who live in developing countries are now industrializing countries. I mean, this absolute nonsense does my head in. But that aside, it's estimated that 1 in 3 children worldwide, which is more than 600 million people, have some degree of lead poisoning, especially those who are living in developing countries or industrializing countries. And interestingly, about 95% of lead is stored in the skeleton. And even a lot of adults still have a degree of lead poisoning from the fact that people are living in houses with paint, lead paint in the older houses, leaded gasoline in the soil, seeping lead from water lines and all those sort of things. So there's still a lot of lead around. And unfortunately, not only does it damage your blood, but it also can cause cognitive defects in children and markedly increase your risk for cardiovascular disease. So lead is a big problem, and we really need to have a public policy to eliminate as much lead from the community and from the environment as we possibly can.
A new low-cost portable device can quickly detect colorectal and prostate cancer, providing a faster and more affordable diagnostic option, especially in regions with limited healthcare resources. This was interesting to read, Ross.
Yeah, this is extraordinary because basically this is just a very, very small device where you get a pinprick of blood, you put it on a little blotting thing on this what's called a new biochip device, and basically it uses nanotechnology to be able to give a pretty accurate diagnosis as to whether you are brewing a colorectal cancer or a prostate cancer. And it's very, very sensitive. And see, the problem is, especially in areas where there's not great health care, this may be something that could be very, very available for people and pick up these diseases pretty early. Because interestingly, in the last 10 years, a lot of the oncologists have moved to what we call a liquid biopsy. And a liquid biopsy, rather than having to take a piece of tissue, and most biopsies are very, very uncomfortable and we'll say painful, whereas with a liquid biopsy, it's just a blood test. And what they find, and it's a similar thing with this particular test, is you find the circulating markers of cancer. So basically, even with early cancers, you're releasing what we call DNA or cancer-specific DNA from that cancer. So the DNA of a cancer in our body is not the same as our DNA, and now it can be picked up pretty early in all these tests, and now they've even got these very low-cost devices. So hopefully this will be rolled out pretty soon and it'll be a bit more widespread in its use.
Last but not least, Arthur sent us a question earlier today. We addressed about vitamin D. This is a vitamin D deficiency in early life can speed up the aging of the thymus, which regulates immune function, Ross.
Yeah, this is an interesting study because this is just getting back to the fact that we've got to be careful with the health in our children, because a lot of people let their kids eat what they like and reasonably so keep them out of the sun because it's not good for their skin. But children need to get a good dose of vitamin D. And this study is showing that the thymus gland, which sits in what we call the anterior mediastinum in front of the heart, the thymus gland, especially in young age, spits out all of these T cells, and T cells are a vital part of the immune system. And the T cells are really our memory cells. So when you get exposed to a bacteria or a virus as a child, those T cells live in the body for the rest of your life. And then as soon as you get re-exposed to that virus or the bacteria, out come the T cells. So you want your thymus to be really doing a lot of its work very early on in your life for the first 10, 15 years, because it starts to shrink down to almost nothing as you get older. And what this is saying is, if you've got a vitamin D deficiency as a child, there's much more rapid shrinking of the thymus. So it's really important for kids to have a good, healthy thymus, and part of that is getting good levels of vitamin D.
My takeaway from that, Ross, is everything shrinks as we get older.
There's no doubt about that whatsoever. As I say, for all us men over 50, everything stiffens up apart from the bit you want to, and that's just how it goes.
Sad but true, sad but true. All right, mate, you're a gentleman and a scholar, as my dad used to say. Thank you so much. We always enjoy our chats with you each and every weekend. Have a good week, mate.
No, you too, mate, and I'll talk to you next week.